नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। टुडे फ्रॉम श्रीमद् भागवतम कैंटो 10 चैप्टर 6 एंटाइटल्ड द किलिंग ऑफ द डीमन पुतना टेक्स्ट 31। प्लीज रिपीट आफ्टर मी। तावन्नन्दादयो गोपा मथुराय व्रजं गता विलोक्य पूतना देहं बभूवुरतिविस्मिता। ट्रांसलेशन। मीनवाइल ऑल द कावहर्ड मेन हेडेड बाय नंद महाराज रिटर्न फ्रॉम मथुरा and when they saw on the way the gigantic body of Putana lying dead, they were struck with great wonder. Purport by His Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. Nanda Maharaj's wonder may be understood in various ways. First of all, the cowherd men had never before seen such a gigantic body in Vrindavan, and therefore they were struck with wonder. Then they began to consider where such a body had come from, whether it had dropped from the sky, or whether by some mistake, or by the power of some mystic yogini, they had come to some place other than Vrindavan. They could not actually guess what had happened, and therefore they were struck with wonder. So we are coming to the end of Putana's demise. I would say Putana's liberation. in the verse, Srila Prabhupada also elaborates about the simplicity of devotees, about their, and also the power of Yogamaya, because we may wonder that these devotees were in the midst of Krishna, but could not fathom how Krishna was the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Even though they did understand that at times, but their overwhelming relationship with Krishna was that of such deep love of a personal nature as a mother or a father or as a cowherd boy or a gopi that overrode all the clinical objective understanding, and so their actions were not based on the fact that he was Supreme Personality of Godhead. It was just based on their sheer deep love. Also, Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur has given his commentary on the various demons, and as he says, they represent various anarthas. And it is interesting to note, because Putana represents pseudo guru, and it would be appropriate to discuss a little bit about what a pseudo guru or a false guru is, particularly because it happens to be today the appearance day of none other than His Divine Grace Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, and also His Holiness Gaur Govind Maharaj, His disappearance day. So the conditioned souls are suffering, living entities are suffering and lurching from side to side, looking for some pleasure. That is the natural quality of the soul of every living entity, that we are looking for some happiness and avoidance of distress. And we don't heed Sukhdev Goswami Maharaj's words that we should be very careful about what he calls the mirage. You know, mirage is a false appearance in a desert which gives the appearance of water when there's no water. We are not so familiar with being in a desert, but some of us may have been there. But for those who even if we have not been, but we have heard about it, Actually, it is amazing how when if you are in a desert with walking for miles and very thirsty, and actually by the trickery of the creation, in the distance we actually see what we are convinced is water, and we run towards it. But actually, so you can imagine if a thirsty person is running towards it, and then desperate to take that next sip of water. So in that desperation, the sense of discrimination gets clouded. We cannot discriminate between what is reality and what is illusion. Run, and then you find that actually there is no water. And what we think is water, we try to take it, and then it is just hot, dry sand. So in fact, instead of quenching our thirst, it makes it worse if we take that the sand. Another example which Sukhdev Goswami Maharaj gives in the fifth canto, very nicely explained, in the similar way, that when a person, making the same point, that when we are desperate for happiness, we are pursuing, if you are so desperate, then our sense of discrimination gets blurred. We are not able to understand through the intelligence, because the intelligence is captured by the senses which and the mind. So the intelligence is also brought down. So imagine in a very scorching heat when we are in the woods, in the forest, and we're so hot, we're feeling so hot, so thirsty, and we walk for miles, and then we come across some sparkling fresh water. Now here the water is there, so it's not a mirage. Actually water is there. But again, we do not, our discrimination is not there, because we're so desperate that we would not we don't want to believe, even if we've heard anything else, but we wouldn't want to believe that. That we want to test what the depth of the water is. And the water may be just 2 feet, and we just plunge into it. And the water is so shallow that just in the desperation of taking that, getting the heat off, we hit our head and break our head. So the comparison is that actually, in this case, there may be a little bit of pleasure of his feeling for a fraction of a second the cool water, before his head breaks, hits the ground. So similarly, the material pleasure, the chase after material pleasure, the trickery of Maya is such that we actually do get a little bit of taste. It's not that it's a complete dryness. And because of that, we are going further. Immediately that we don't know when that that pleasure, so-called pleasure, is turned into misery. Because we feel that we've tasted it, so it is just round the corner. And we just have to continue doing it, and we go from one end to the other. So eventually we break our head. So for a little pleasure, we have a fractured skull, perhaps. So this is really how the material nature works. It is just the nature of the way the Krishna has created, that oftentimes, most of the times, the solutions are actually worse than the problems. That we may think that the problem is there and we need to solve it, but in fact, it makes it worse. So if you go and ask the person who may have had this in the mirage, who ran and took the dry sand and ate it, you say, I would have tolerated the thirst, but rather than having the sand. Or somebody who has run headlong into the water, he was thirsty. Now, if he says, "I wish I had, I would have tolerated that thirst a little bit more rather than have a broken head." So, but now you can't undo it. So, therefore, it's too late, and then we are lamenting, and then we are again hankering. So, this lamentation hankering takes place. The lamentation doesn't last. It's what we routinely call the Smashan Vairagya. It, when somebody take the body to the procession, and all the philosophy comes to our mind, and we know how futile the body is, how temporary it is, we are not this body. Sometimes it lasts, maybe by the time you come out of the Smashan Gura, sometimes it lasts one day, it may last a week, but not very long. So, unless we have the constant association of the Shastras and the pure knowledge through the Acharyas. Another example which Srila Prabhupada gives is of the fly. You know, when the fly gets caught in the spider's web, if you've seen how amazing, in fact, how the spider creates the web itself is extraordinary. But once the fly gets entangled, the fly, the more it actually tries to extricate itself, the more it gets entangled. So, what he calls, what Prabhupada calls is the endless entanglement. It is no end to it. Now it's finished. And then not knowing that it's already entangled and it's making things worse, but the fly will keep on entangling and the fly will keep on entangling and then it gets more and more entangled until it loses its life. So, in this desperation, when we go either here, there, and the examples are given of how we may make mistakes. In this thinking conditioning, people, including devotees, you know, would go to find anywhere somebody who who gives the appearance of knowledge, and that is where the so-called gurus, swamis, yogis, come in the picture. And of course, they do have, some of them have mystic powers, some of them can create gold. But in that mysticism, the people who are in desperation, they are not able to use their sense of discrimination, the objectivity of comparing what is real gold or what is real value of instructions, rather than the superficial appearance. The pseudoness, or the shallowness, the falsities, where it is almost the same but not quite. So it's not that you are comparing chalk and cheese. You know, if you take chalk, which you write on the board, and cheese, they don't even look together. But here, they are fairly similar at one glance. You hear some things which make a little bit of sense, and it may be the dress, maybe the appearance, maybe the charisma. Perhaps some things that are spoken, but then the similarity ends there. And then the deeper we look at, the more futile it is. But then by that time it is too difficult for us to change. And it is amazing, His Holiness Radhanath Maharaj once made the point that it is amazing how wealthy people actually find novel ways, you know, absurd ways of creating, finding sense gratification to get out of these problems, to think, to create happiness. So, the point is that the pursuit of well-being, material well-being, is so ingrained in us that actually we just equate happiness with prosperity, material prosperity, that we just cannot think that without material prosperity, how we could, be happy. We may say, okay, yeah, I'm doing my spiritual things, I'm listening, I'm hearing, but this is most important, and without that it doesn't work. And we do not discriminate or we do not use our objectivity to actually see that all around us, people who have got accumulated masses of wealth, in fact, if we go a little bit deeper and see how miserable they are, or how difficult, and they have to keep up the pretenses because that is important for their existence, for their own ego, and also for their social circles, family circles. So it's even more of a strain to keep up the pretenses of what is not. But the average person is just taken by the grandeur, by the externality, and therefore feels that he's happy, she's happy, and the happiness is equal to having A, B, C of these various material assets, and once I reach that, I will be also in the same position. And that's where the futility is, that's where we become like the fly, we get entangled. Instead of relying on Krishna, instead of knowing that Krishna is the supplier of everything, instead of knowing that we will get what we are destined to get, they keep working hard at whatever we are doing, but putting the proprietorship of Krishna in the center is the most important aspect. Krishna is the one which all the others are zeros. So if you have many other attributes or many talents, much intelligence, etc., it has no value unless we apply it to Krishna. And once we apply it to Krishna, then whatever he provides, is everything is coming from him. And if we are trained by the association of saintly persons to see that whatever comes to us from Krishna is his mercy. It is his causeless mercy. After all, we have been so fortunate to be given this mercy of getting the association of this temple and many extraordinary personalities. Similarly, events that happen in our life are also meant for giving us this that understanding that actually everything comes from Krishna. No matter if our wrong understanding may think that this is painful and this is happy, but we should have the faith in the higher transcendental knowledge, even if we have not understood it, because only in that, by putting that faith, that's a little faith in the beginning becomes stronger faith with association and with following a sincere path, and then in the real faith we will actually be able to appreciate and understand. So that's the stretch of determination that we need to have, that with the small faith initially that we have, that we don't let go in spite of whatever happens in the external world. And while we are going through that, we while we come to a stage where our faith becomes stronger, which could be depending on our sincerity, then it makes actually things, everything becomes clear. But initially, that's why we say that Shravanam is the most important, that we hear the philosophical words. And our main discrimination is to decide whom we listen to and whom we follow. Once we follow, then we should put our faith in them. So, the kind of guidance that we get from various people, maybe for material benefits, it may also be that people, some of the guidance may not be directly material, and therefore we feel that, oh, he's spiritual because he's teaching me some yogic asanas or some meditation techniques, some raising of kundalini or, you know, various sorts. So there may be some value in all of this, but that value is linked to how much we ultimately, or even the person who's guiding us, is actually putting Krishna in the center of all his activities and all his talk. Because if we disassociate if we avoid this, then though there'll be some value, but ultimately following the Bhagavad Gita instructions, which the end Krishna says, Sarva Dharman Parityaja Mam Ekam Sharanam Bhaja, abandon all varieties of religion, just surrender to me, this will not come. So that is the most important aspect with whatever we do. So any activity we do which can enhance our health, our emotional well-being, our psychological good well-being, we may hear, feel good lectures, which is all, it has some value, it is not necessarily negative, but its value would be very much limited unless we, or it perhaps it could even misguide us if we do not see the link with that, or if it is taking us away from the understanding that actually we are not the masters of our destiny, which is what many of these things lead us to, that you know, we will get success, and if we do taste success, we feel we are the creators. The ultimate faith has to be in Krishna. There's a once when Srila Prabhupada was on a railway platform and he was going to the catching a train, so one person was running after him asking him, you know, as soon as he saw that there's a sadhu and, you know, a lot of his followers are behind him, so as is quite common to see that many people feel that I should have his blessings. So this person kept running after him saying, give me blessings, Swamiji, give me blessings. And Prabhupada kept walking, he went, he got into the train, sat down, this person persevered, he kept pushing, went through all the devotees who were around him, and went and fell at Prabhupada's feet and said, no, Swamiji, give me blessings, give me blessings. And he didn't know who Prabhupada was, and just seeing saffron, and he just wanted, Prabhupada sensed that primarily the what is this person wants is for his own selfish material needs. So Prabhupada very compassionately but very sincerely looked at him and he said, I give you my blessings that all your material life is finished. So this person was so shocked, you know, he started crying. He says, Swamiji, this is not the blessings I want. You know? So the thing is that we have a certain notion and we want those words to come out of someone's mouth and which we feel very nice. So this is where Prabhupada, the same person who was so compassionate, you know, and here also is out of his compassion because he could immediately, a pure devotee can immediately sense where, know where this other person is coming from. And just out of, in the hope that this person, if not today, tomorrow, with some experiences that may come, may somehow heed this advice which came through a blessing. And actually his spiritual life would begin when he would understand that whatever happens to a material life, it is not in our hands. So Prabhupada said that in Kali Yuga, because of the this nature of people, where they are hankering for material prosperity and so on, in turn, if there are cheaters, the yogis or others who are not giving the right advice, then in fact they have the tremendous power and influence. And this influence and power comes because of the people who want to follow. So it feeds on itself. There are people who want it, and as soon as they see some halo or some, if you do not see whether it's coming from any sampradaya, what is the philosophy that is being taught, then we may be in a difficulty. So Prabhupada also says then, who is a real guru? And when he was referring to his Guru Maharaj Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, he said a real guru is one whose nature is such whereby just by the association of such a person, we start becoming attached to Krishna and we start becoming detached from the material pursuits. So that's the nature of such a person. When we associate with that personality, over time, following him, our attachment to the Lord increases and our detachment from material pursuits starts decreasing. And he also gives the knowledge by how we can achieve that through the 9 processes of devotional service. And he takes us through the path. So that is really a real guru. Not someone who is looking at his gain. He's looking at our gain. He's completely, when we say selfless, means the person has no, the pure devotee has no desire for himself. His only desire is to see, try to see, make others connected to Krishna. This is the only desire. Whatever they do is only in that, with that pursuit in mind. And if you see the history of, say, Bhaktivinoda Thakur, who was really the modern day transformer of, or you can say the cleanser of the whole Chaitanya Mahaprabhu movement, which had gone into some decay in the middle. And then Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur and Srila Prabhupada. One common factor you will see is, apart from the power of prayer, when they prayed to the Lord, but each of them was looking to, like Bhaktivinoda Thakur's only prayer was, that send me, he said, the ray of Vishnu, which through which Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur came. Basically to spread the holy name around, to spread Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's message, and to stop the decay that is going on. Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj also, when he was helpless, and he was given the order to continue that path in the future, he was given by, Bhaktivinoda Thakur had given him the instructions. So he also made the one single prayer was that, please, I'm all alone, what can I do? And he had the vision, which we'll talk about later, which actually gave him that strength to carry on. And Prabhupada also, we know now in his Jaladut voyage, when he had heart attacks, and then he prayed before he reached the Boston Harbor, he wrote that beautiful poem, and he said, I'm just a puppet in your hands. So again, his prayer was only this, that make me dance. That means whatever you want, but he sacrificed everything, all the comforts of his, of the staying in Vrindavan, and he was already a pure devotee. He was as close to Krishna as one can even, can't even imagine. He didn't, but he gave that all up, so-called gave it up. Actually, he took Krishna with him everywhere, took Vrindavan with him. But he went through so much suffering only because he wanted, his prayer was to see that people, to follow his Guru Maharaj's orders and to see that how people can benefit. So this is really where the pure devotee is thinking is, just to help others. A very nice example to explain how this works is again given by Srila Prabhupada, when he talks about the wood. And he, wood is just a dry element, but the fire is within that wood. So when you look at the wood, it has no value, it has no potential, the potential of the fire is not realized. But when you light the fire, the fire element is introduced into the wood, immediately it blazes. So Srila Prabhupada very nicely explains that actually all of us, you know, the conditioned soul is like wood, and the spiritual master is like the fire. So as soon as the fire actually ignites, immediately the inherent potential, the what is there within, the potential, the pure love of God which is there within everyone, can awaken. So that awakening process is when we go to a genuine guru who can bring that path. And then once the blazing fire takes up, then you get not only the light, but you also get the fire, the heat. So the light of knowledge is there, and then the heat actually burns all the anarthas. These anarthas are destroyed over time just by the awakening of this transcendental knowledge which is already within. So it was, and this we can see on a day-to-day example. When we see a log of wood which is just wood, there is nothing, it is lying dormant, it is unused. But the minute you make you spark it, and you can see the potential coming through. So Krishna says that by following the regulative principles of freedom, one can actually get the mercy of the Lord. And that is also quoted by Srila Prabhupada often. So when you talk of the regulative principles, devotees here are familiar that we follow the four regulative principles, broadly the four regulative principles about no meat eating, intoxication, gambling and illicit sex. People generally feel, many of us also feel that, well, it's a restriction, we have to follow the restriction. But Krishna says it's actually the the regulative principles of freedom. It actually frees us. And that's what Prabhupada explains, that by following the regulative principles, it is not that we are as many you know, so-called sadhus and gurus may criticize the Hare Krishna movement, saying that it is such a restrictive movement. You keep you know, restraining ourselves, you keep this, you know, you can't do this, can't do that. Actually, yes, you have to restrain the senses, but you initially, by avoiding the following the regulative principles and avoiding the gross sensual, sinful activities, we actually are able to participate in higher, positive, dynamic services. Which also, through our experiences, we see in the last whatever. If you have come in the last 6 months or last 2 years, 5 years, if you are associated with the ISKCON movement, we see this is the vibrancy of the movement. That how much energy, how much passion is actually generated to just serve the Lord through serving some projects, serving, giving your time, your energy, your consciousness for that. So this is to be experienced. One cannot, but at the same time, from the outside it may look like restrictions, but actually they are regulative principles. So this is where we have a test. When we are, we may survey and we may sample so many paths. We may go to hear various lectures, that is including an ISKCON, you know, a tape of some ISKCON guru, we may hear all that. But we need to objectively analyze as to what is it that we're looking for and what is the real truth. And if we are comparing it with the scriptures, the scriptures have to be, and the genuine scriptures like Bhagavad Gita, or anything that is connected to Krishna, Bhagavatam, if what is spoken there is also matched by people who echo the same words, who represent the same words, then we know we are on the same path. And if it is also spoken by earlier acharyas, so that is where the parampara comes. So there is a very interesting story of one yogi who, this was quoted by His Holiness Radhanath Swami, he has actually met this person several times. This yogi from India, he had developed some yogic techniques and he became extremely famous. He was famous in India, but when he went to the West in the 60s and 70s, he became very, very famous. And then he had several thousands of followers, and at one time he was the most influential spiritualist in the West. And he happened to meet Prabhupada. And he was actually very much appreciative of Prabhupada. He started telling Prabhupada that you are, Swamiji, it's amazing. We all come here, we're teaching some massage therapies or meditation techniques. We teach, asanas and so on for the benefit thing. But you are actually teaching them to surrender, sarva dharma, and you are telling them surrender Krishna. I'm telling this to Americans. I don't think anybody else could do this. And we are seeing that you have so many followers. So it's quite astonishing. So what you achieve. So Prabhupada was not taken in by the praise. The person was genuinely praising. He was not flattered. He actually spoke that. But he was not taken. Prabhupada didn't see that. Prabhupada was very calm. And he just looked at him in the eye and said that, if you know that Krishna is the goal, then why are you cheating the public? So, but this person actually later on told others, including Radhanath Swami, that he had more respect for Prabhupada after he got chastised. And much later, when he had this person had some difficulties and he was not able to he got influenced by Maya and he was having problems, and he used to visit the Hare Krishna temples to hear lectures. So at least this person, though in his heyday when he was making a lot of money by practicing and his own theory, but he knew in his heart of hearts what Prabhupada was saying is the truth. And Prabhupada said that if I compromise I will be cheating. So that is why he called it Bhagavad Gita as it is. He said the truth. Another incident was when another yogi who approached Prabhupada to invite him for a conference. And this conference, this yogi was actually representing the Sikh Dharma. And when he came to Prabhupada, they were having a conference on unity of religions and peace on earth. So he came and very respectfully was telling Prabhupada various things. And then Prabhupada started speaking. So he had a notebook and he was writing down. So Prabhupada said, he instructed him, he said, you can write down in a notebook, that a conference will be a failure. So Prabhupada was, that person was very surprised, and he's saying, then Prabhupada explained, saying, what did Guru Nanak teach? Did he not teach the Bhagavad Gita? He said, yes. So he said, why are you not teaching the Bhagavad Gita? What is Bhagavad Gita saying? Surrender to Krishna. So Prabhupada was always sticking to the truth. But at the same time, his compassion was, this is out of his compassion. We may say he was not trying to, never in his life was he trying to try to be one up on somebody. He didn't need to be. He was a fully realized soul. It was only out of his anxiety to help others, including those who are on the wrong path. So, and we have so many millions of examples. I mean, there are devotees who are still on this planet, and then we have read about it, and virtually everything that he did for people who had difficulties. If somebody was fallen, Prabhupada had no problems with that. If somebody repeatedly fell, if he could not follow, if Prabhupada was so compassionate, he would cry for that devotee, even if he has come back and again he left, because in those days, you know, the it was the initial days, and especially in the West, the allurement of Maya was so so strong, as it is even now, that to take root, it takes time. So devotees, some people would come and go back, and Prabhupada would really, his heart would was pained to see the other people suffering. The same person, but when it came to establishing the truth, he would not compromise. And you do it in a way which would not hurt others. It would be very blunt, but never hurtful. And there's this classic example, of course, what a materialistic guru is. If we look at the Srimad Bhagavatam, in the story of Bali Maharaj, and we talk of Shukracharya. Shukracharya was the guru of the asuras, and therefore he was, Bali Maharaj was his leading disciple. And Shukracharya was not just an ordinary guru, as we may think that, you know, compared to, he was just not somebody who was just producing gold or something. He could, with his mantras, produce, create cities. You know, he had such power, and while he was guiding the asuras, there was nothing that the demigods could do that could dislodge the asuras from the power, the demons. And there was always an ongoing battle between the demons and the demigods. And in order to save the demigods, then ultimately, it's a long story, but when Lord Vishnu comes as Mohini Murti, a very, very extraordinarily beautiful form, female form, which was so captivating, and the nectar which was already churned out of the by the demons and the devatas together. So you know, by that time the nectar was going to go to the demons. So Mohini Murti came and just attracted the minds of all the demons such a way that she took the nectar and gave it to the demigods. Whoever would take the nectar would become extremely powerful, invincible. After taking the nectar, the demigods became invincible. So earlier the demigods were always on the losing side. They were always being defeated. Now the demigods became very powerful. And then in the ensuing battle, unlike in the past, they actually slaughtered all the demons. They actually killed all the demons, including Bali Maharaj. They were killed, finished. Now see the sample of Shukracharya's power, that he created some situation, some potion, in which he then, when he dipped the bodies of the demons, including Bali Maharaj, they came back alive. He could not only create cities, he could also bring people back from the dead. That was his power. So he brought back all the demons, thousands of them, back to life. And they became not only more powerful, but also more effulgent and more strong than before. And with this strength, they went after the demigods. And because the demigods were now in real fear, when Indra turned to Brihaspati and said that, now what do we do? So Brihaspati said that the only thing you can do is to run and hide. There's nothing you can do to stop them. And all the demigods had to hide. And then Bali Maharaj and the demons, they took over the entire Swargalok and all the demigods' planets. And they were ruling over it. And then because of the sincere prayers of the kind-heartedness of Aditi and her husband who prayed, and then Upendra comes, then in the form of a dwarf Brahmin, that is Vamandev. And now, as when Vamandev comes to Bali Maharaj, he actually, he's dressed as a Brahmin. Bali Maharaj is actually sitting in another yajna. He was about to, for looking at even greater strength. So when Vamandev approaches him, and immediately seeing this dwarf boy, knowing that this is a Brahmin, so Bali Maharaj smiled and said, "What can I do for you? You know, charity is in my disposition. I would like to help, give you something." So Vamandev, the Lord is also expert in diplomacy. He knows how to just as he had done earlier, when the demigods had come crying to him, saying that, "No, save us from the demons," before he came as Mohini Murti, the Lord had actually told them that, "Okay, you negotiate and cooperate with the demons, and then jointly you produce this nectar." So same way, now also he uses, Vamandev speaks very, very nicely. It's very beautiful how he starts glorifying all his ancestors. He including says that Hiranyakashipu was so powerful, so strong, and Hiranyaksha also was such a great personality, and Prahlad Maharaj was so generous. Because these are all ancestors. Prahlad Maharaj was the grandfather of Bali Maharaj, and Hiranyakashipu was the great grandfather of Bali Maharaj. So like that, he said, "Isankai, you are so generous, so therefore you also should supply what I want." And Bali Maharaj said, "Of course, tell me what you want." So then Vamandev says that, I want that much land in which my three paces of steps, three steps can cover. So Bali Maharaj just laughed out and said, I cannot understand what you are asking. Why are you asking only for three paces of land, three steps of land? Because I can give you palaces, I can give you islands in the ocean of existence, material existence. I can give you planets, I can give you fame, I can give you so many things. Why you want only this? Then Vamandev tells him, it's an instruction for all of us. It instructs him. He says, if one is not satisfied with a little, one will never be satisfied with whatever you get. And I am a satisfied person from within. So I am happy. Just give me my three steps. So Bali Maharaj said, fine, definitely I'll give you. And then he started doing the preparations to solemnize this vow. He was about to wash the feet of Vamandev. And then Shukracharya, the same Shukracharya who was watching all this, he was absolutely horrified. You know, and such was the power of Shukracharya that he burst out, and he actually ordered, I mean, he first chastised Bali Maharaj, who was the king of the universe by that time. He took all the planets, and he said, "You are a fool, you know, you are a rascal. You don't understand that this is this dwarf is actually Vishnu. He's come, he's a supreme personality of Godhead." And Shukracharya was such a scholar, he could understand everything. He said, you do not know, he's come to take everything from you." He even told him, he says, he's going to ask this, why he's asking for three steps? Because in two steps he will cover everything. And you will have no place to put the third. Then he will arrest you. And then you will be, and you want to fulfill your promise, he will not allow you to fulfill your promise. So you will be humiliated. So what is the use? This was the power that he could understand everything. And yet he was, his arrogance was such that he could not actually see, he understood who Supreme Person, see, this is the understanding that the mentally he could understand everything, but he could not accept the fact that he had to be subordinate or surrendered to him. So one can take note of this, that when we look at, if you go only by the power of intelligence or knowledge, nobody can be more intelligent or powerful in mind than Shukracharya was. It's incredible how not only he had such feats to be able to create Bali Maharaj and others from the dead, but he could also see through everything. And he was he had brought up Bali Maharaj's strength to the level where it is was now. When they were dead, he brought them back to life. He gave him all the strength to conquer the entire all the planets. And he was not about to just let Bali Maharaj just give it away just because he was making a foolish mistake, according to him. So he told all this, that you should see, he's going to take everything away, etc. And Bali Maharaj heard all this, you know, the chastisement, and he heard. Then he contemplated for some time, and then he spoke. And he told Shukracharya, "I am the grandson of Prahlad Maharaj, and I will like to follow in his footsteps. I have given my word to a Brahmin. Once I have given my word, I cannot retract it. Mother Earth has said that she can tolerate as any amount of weight, but she cannot, the any burden of weight she can take, but not the burden of a liar. So I have to fulfill my promise. I will do it. And so what if I lose everything? I'm not afraid of losing everything. I'm not afraid of death. I'm not afraid of any kind of shame. I'm only fearful of offending a Brahmin. So Bali Maharaj is, why he is considered one of the 12 Mahajans. When people say that, you know, we may think that he's a demon, king of the demons, he defeated the demigods. But this is where we can see when he had to make an instant decision. Now, he could have taken any amount of, if you had to take a momentary split second decision of the most important aspect of your life, you know, it's virtually life and death issue for him, and he's the king of the universe, he could have said also that perhaps that, you know, this is not fair, this is cheating. You know, you have changed the rules of the game. I mean, you asked me straightforward and I did it. I gave you what I had. Or he could have told also that, in a very meek way, that I've given you everything. Now, what can I do? You know, you have only in your two steps covered everything. I have nothing to give. But this is the combination of his purity, his elevation, his spirituality and his... his purified intelligence, that in a split second he immediately offered his head. He said, you can put your third step. Before that, actually, no, he was already humiliated. So, when he surrendered, I skipped one part. That Shukracharya then chastised him, but Bali Maharaj says, I will allow him to do it. I'll fulfill the promise. Let him take the three pieces. So then he tells Vamandev, that you please go ahead. And then Vamandev does exactly what Shukracharya predicted. As we know, that he expanded himself as Trivikram, and with one step he covered the lower and middle planets, the second step he covered the upper planets, in fact pierced the sky, and the Mother Ganges came down and washed his feet. There was no place. And then Vamandev ordered Garudji to arrest Bali Maharaj, and by that time Prahlad Maharaj also had come, the grandfather. He was quite happy seeing this, because he just seeing the Lord, he was very happy, and he saw that Bali Maharaj was giving the highest test of his life. So he was arrested like a common criminal, and he was tied up. He couldn't even move. He couldn't even bend his head to pay obeisances to Prahlad Maharaj's grandfather. So you can imagine in moments how his life changed, from a king of the universe to becoming like a common criminal, tied, you know, humiliated in front of everybody, practically the world. So this is when he makes a split second decision, and he was, instead of, you know, saying anything, immediately offered and said that, Vamandev says, then what about my third step? You promised and you are not able to give. Then he said, actually, he put his head, and said, you put your head, put your third foot on my head. So that is why in our nine processes of devotional service, the last one, Atmanivedanam, complete surrender, the example is given of Bali Maharaj, where by body, mind, words, literally, he was prepared to give his life, and he didn't mind, as he was telling Shukracharya, that what is the harm if we lose everything? He was quoting, he said there were saints like Dadichi and others who actually gave up their life, Maharaj Shibi. They were prepared to give up their life for a higher cause. So I'm happy. And also, he told Shukracharya that everything is temporary. You know, all the acquisitions, the wealth, the fame, everything is going to go at the time of death. But reputation is one thing which can go on. So if I do the right things, then that reputation will be carried into the future. So that is where the sense of discrimination comes. And Bali Maharaj is a perfect example of how, even though he took the guidance and help, but then when it really came to the test, he actually passed the test in flying colors. So in this way, Bali Maharaj was rewarded. And then, of course, Vamandev was so pleased at seeing the surrender, and he gave him the planet Sutala Lok. And he said that, I will myself come there as a doorkeeper in your planet. because I cannot do without your association. This is the Lord telling his devotee. And Prahlad Maharaj also said that I would also be coming there because I also want your association. So, Srila Prabhupada gives a very nice example of that if we really want the real thing, we have to actually pay the price for it. So when we talk of false guru and real guru, and sometimes, oftentimes, the path that is shown to us, it may be looking very challenging, very difficult. But Prabhupada says that if you want, it's like plastic jewelry. If you want plastic jewelry, millions of people will come because it's cheap. And if it's cheap, then a lot of people will come. So anything that is available on the market, so to say, lots of people will come, and therefore you may also feel that since everyone is doing it, it must be true. But he said, he mentioned about Tiffany's, which is one of the most expensive jewelry shops in the world, in the Fifth Avenue. Then he said that how many people will go into that shop in Tiffany's, which is millions of dollars per piece oftentimes. So only a few people will go. So that way, if you really want the, if you want the real thing, if you want the real jewel, then you have to pay the price. So the price that a devotee is willing to pay is through his service attitude. And actually that is the constitutional position of the living entity. That is the natural feeling, that we are either serving the senses or we are serving the Lord. So when we are following the real guru, we are not really going off the, we are actually, if we just remove the cloud of ignorance initially, and then or it is removed by the holy name and by the scriptures, and gradually we will find the taste. And when we find the taste, then we are happily following this the path, and then in which enhances our faith, and then in which increases our determination to follow the path, and even in the face of challenges which are going to come in future. Today is also a very, very extraordinarily special day, because it is, as I mentioned earlier, the appearance day of His Holiness God Govind Maharaj, and because His Divine Grace Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur, the Guru of Srila Prabhupada. So I'd like to briefly talk about His Holiness God Govind Maharaj for a few minutes, and then also we'll speak a little bit on Bhakti Siddhanta Maharaj. And after me, Adikesha Prabhu will also speak on Bhakti Siddhanta Maharaj, because that is, I think we will all greatly benefit in just understanding what kind of this personality he was. But the reason I wanted to also talk about His Holiness God Govind Maharaj is because very few people are aware of him, and he was actually a disciple of Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. So actually he is, in a sense, in our generation, so to say, in the last 20-30 years. God Govind Maharaj was actually born in 1929 in Orissa, and his name was, that time was Braj Bandhu. He was a very unusual person. From childhood he had a Krishna conscious background, and his grandfather was like a paramhans. His only day he used to just keep chanting the holy names and cry in front of the deities. His entire day would spend in that. So from childhood, this Braj Bandhu was taken by his uncles. They used to go to different villages, performing harinams, doing kirtans. And at the age of 6, he developed a very strong attraction for their own Gopal deity, which was known as Gopal Jiu. And he was, by that time, by the age of 6, he used to make garlands for his Gopal, and also singing hymns, bhajans, and many times you read from the under candlelight, he would be reading the words on the palm, which is written in those palm manuscript. They were very poor actually, financially. By the age of 8, his Braj Bandhu had read the entire Bhagavad Gita, Bhagavatam, and Chaitanya Charitamrita. And not only read it, but he could also explain the significance. So, a very unusual person. Then, when he was in his 20s, his father died, and his widowed mother requested, so he got married. And then the responsibility came on him to maintain the house. And because they had no money, he couldn't go to university. But he he was so brilliant, also so intelligent, that he just by studying in the night, along with his other duties, he passed his BA and his BEd and became a school teacher. And even when he was in school, he used to, whenever he could keep Krishna, because he was so attached to his own deity and to spiritual life. It was just natural for him that he would actually preach to the children also. Whenever he could bring Krishna conscious subjects into the regular subjects. 30 years later, some of his students actually became his disciples also. And he was very very mild and very humble person. But when he spoke, he became like a lion. So again, you know, Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj, I think they have some common links, our gurus, that they're genuinely, personally, very, very humble. But when they take the role of representative of Krishna, they really... So he was very powerful. And of course, he was such a strong scholar. He had that he even right to the last days, he would always quote from go into details and quote the references of the Vedic scriptures and where he's taken from. And he would also sometimes ask people in the audience, in his disciples, and he would expect, he would demand that they also know the references, because in a preaching movement they should know, they can back up the arguments. So he was a very strong preacher. By the age of 45, that was on, I think, 8th or 9th November, April 1974. He renounced everything and he just took a begging bowl and a Bhagavad Gita and was wandering all over, went to all the holy places, and for a year he was preaching, going all around, and finally he came to Vrindavan. And 2 weeks after he came to Vrindavan, he came in contact with some Western devotees, and through them he came in contact with Srila Prabhupada. The very first time he met Srila Prabhupada, Prabhupada just finished his prasad, and Braj Bandhu comes to him and meets him, and Prabhupada asks him in Bengali, as he says, so have you taken sannyas? So he says, no. He said, I will give you sannyas. So in that correspondence, in that communication, he immediately understood, God Govind Maharaj understood that Prabhupada knows my heart, and he surrendered to him. And on Krishna Balaram's ISKCON Vrindavan temple's opening day in 1975, April 75, he took initiation and sannyas. Everything on one day. It was a talk also among ISKCON that how this has not happened, how come one person... But this is Prabhupada's understanding. He was already 45 and his whole lifestyle was very different. It was not like... Prabhupada could understand where his associates were coming from. So anyway, he gave him the instructions that you preach in Orissa. So he went to Orissa, and then under enormous difficulties, great challenges, he started... implementing his Guru Maharaj's order. There was no money, and you know, Orissa is also a very poor state. And he started translating Prabhupada's books into Orissa. And there was a land donated in Bhubaneswar, outside Bhubaneswar, where the present temple is. But this land also was actually, that time there was no habitation nearby, so it was very difficult. It was fully infested with not only mosquitoes but scorpions and snakes. And at night he would stay sometimes with the there was a tea dealer, a dealer of tea, so in his storeroom was there, so he would spend the night there, which was nearby. Sometimes he would sleep in the construction worker's hut, but he just remained there for several years, during the daytime he would go around on a bicycle, behind a bicycle peddler, catching the, you know, trying to get small donations. So that's where he slowly, slowly built up the temple, which was eventually, there was a grand opening of this magnificent temple in 1991. So this is one of the bicycle peddlers became his disciple, Sachinandan Prabhu. He's in one of the leading disciples. So people who came in contact with him really appreciated. And that way he spent his life, and especially going to the interiors, and put a huge amount of preaching effort. And then in 1996, on the appearance day of His Divine Grace Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, he was in Mayapur, Gaur Govind Maharaj. He was already given the name Gaur Govind Swami. And he was in his room, and two senior devotees came into the room in the evening time. And they spoke to him. They had never met him, and they had heard about him. They had heard his tapes also. So they were intrigued. So they came and said, "Could we speak to you?" So he wasn't keeping too well, but he was meeting people. He was attending meetings. So he called them in the room, and then they were talking to him. And their first question was that, why did Chaitanya Mahaprabhu stay in Jagannath Puri? So, you know, he got, Gaur Govind Maharaj was delighted. You know, he was very happy to start. And then he spoke on several subjects. He spoke on the confidential pastimes of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. And he also spoke about the, very feelingly, about the separation of Radha and Krishna when Krishna left Vrindavan. And then his voice got choked when he was explaining how the feelings, because he was also very expressive. When he used to give lectures, it was very powerful, very magnetic, but he would get himself completely involved in his talks. So he was explaining about then, how when Krishna met, saw Radharani, then these were his words. He said, you know, they had eye-to-eye contact, eye-to-eye union, Krishna and Radha. It was choking that time. And then he got so overwhelmed. So he and then, you know, he said that Krishna, then his eyes became big, and he manifested as Lord Jagannath. And then he said about that this you know, when Krishna saw Radharani and they had eye to eye contact, and he got overwhelmed. So he said, "I'm sorry, I cannot speak." And he then everything was silent in the room, and he lay down on the bed. And then the last words he spoke to all, he just very barely audibly, he just told everyone that, "Naam karo, naam karo." So everyone started chanting, and he lay down on the bed. So the servant came and he put his beloved Gopal Jiyu's photo in his hand. And just looking at the photo, and he moments later, and just called out Gopal, and he left this world. So very perfect beginning, very perfect end, and also gives us a understanding, a glimpse of what the personality of Srila Prabhupada was, that he could attract such a wide variety of personalities and devotees who came and who have spread all over. See, our own understanding is limited to what is happening in Mumbai, that also in this part. But if we really reproduce it and see, there is not only other temples in Mumbai, but it's not only other temples in Maharashtra, but there are in many in India, and what to speak of every planet, 400 temples in the world. And Prabhupada's mood had always been that the temple, he always built very beautiful temples, no doubt, because then people will come there. But his mood was to go beyond that. Everywhere, it is always a preaching movement. Devotees are always encouraged to, out of their own compassion, contact people to bring them, to give them the, many will spurn the chance, but some may take it up. And those who spurn it also, perhaps at some point in time, they will look back and say that, well, you know, when that somebody came and gave me that first contact. So some people may take time. But this is that mood, and this is what was very much exemplified by His Holiness Gaur Govind Maharaj. A tremendous preacher, completely dedicated. And to assist his beloved spiritual master, he came into this world in such a way, as a in a very wonderful Vaishnava family, a great pedigree of devotees, even though they were very poor, had never eaten in his life, he has never took prasad which was not accepted, which was not offered to the Lord. What to speak of, we may say in a city of Mumbai, we have to worry that you may, that somebody most probably may have eaten non-vegetarian and then come, or have, here there is no question of that, but there is a question of not, he has never eaten any prasad which was not offered to the Lord from the time he was born. That was the culture of even in the villages and in the late 20s, early 30s. So that is, we are very privileged that, and it was that we have this example just, what, 16 years ago, he departed from this world. And of course his preaching is going on very strongly by his disciples. And now we like to talk about Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur, his divine grace. His divine grace, just to get the context of how he appeared, if we understand, in the late 19th century, his father, Bhakti Vinod Thakur, who we consider, who was actually, you can say, the resurrector of the modern day Chaitanya Mahaprabhu movement. And he has been, you can say, the chosen one. I mean, in the parampara, we have, all the gurus are perfect. But within that, some gurus have always been given some specific tasks. And his was one of the most challenging tasks. Apart from establishing the actual birthplace of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, which itself was a Herculean task, because everyone was considering it as another place. But other than that, he was the only one who was actually making public attacks and trying to clean up, because there was a lot of misconceptions and wrong notions about Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's philosophy had also been, a lot of deviants had taken over and giving wrong interpretations. And Bhakti Vinod Thakur was the one who powerfully and publicly attacked all those misconceptions to try to bring it to the on the right lines. And he felt all alone, and he prayed to the Lord that, please help me, please send me a ray of Vishnu. These were his words, a ray of Vishnu who can help me to spread your mission all over the world, to spread. And he could see that the people were so hungry for Krishna consciousness, but he needed help. And his fourth child was Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur. His name was Bimal Prasad at birth, and born to Bhakti Vinod Thakur and Bhagwati Devi, also a very pure saintly person. And he was such a divine child. From the, there were many incidents when he was only 6 months old, and then Jagannath Puri, and the garland of Jagannath, when his mother went to put the child in front of the Lord, at that time only the garland from Lord Jagannath fell onto the child. Even when he was born, the umbilical cord was also tied around him, around the child, just like a janoi. So there were many signs which, and as he grew, which convinced Bhakti Vinod Thakur that yes, my prayers have been fulfilled. In answer to my prayers, Lord has sent this child. And right from a very early age, he was a very pure, saintly child. And just he had no inclination whatsoever, even in his youth, for sense gratification. Absolutely none. When he joined college, he formed a club. Now, this is probably common to many. We all go into some club or the other. Some may go, either there are some wild clubs which may be all doing some wild activities, but there are some which have transcended that. They may have, okay, club for photography, club for mathematics, or maybe even higher than that, club for philosophy, or some higher studies, which is, so you have levels. He formed a club where all the members took a vow of lifelong celibacy. Of course, he was the only one who eventually followed it. But you can imagine his mood, that at that age, in his youth, he formed a club and he convinced, that was his power, that so many people were attracted. And they, in their all earnestness and all glories to them, they also took that vow initially of lifelong celibacy. This was his mood of whatever he did. He was always a true servant of the Lord. But the scholarship of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati was outstanding. He was a scholar of Persian, he was a scholar of Arabic. He could, and of course all the Shastras he had known. And he became very devoted to his father in helping him to propagate Krishna consciousness. And his father kept telling him often that, explain to him how the world is desperate for Krishna consciousness. The world is starving for Krishna consciousness. And you know, everything we do, we should try to spread the holy name. So in that effort to spread the holy name, he used to help his father to organize preaching programs and you know, writing books, organizing the printing presses, and a very dynamic personality also. At one stage when he was just in his teens and his father had to go to a very important conference, he represented his father. So he went, did a huge amount of preaching programs on his own. And the extraordinary nature of his humility and is demonstrated by how he took initiation. Now, he took initiation not from his father. His father, when he went to his father, because father was his guru, he took him in, he brought him to Krishna consciousness. So he was a Shiksha guru. But when he wanted to take Diksha, the Bhaktivinoda Thakur instructed him that he should take from God Kishordas Babaji Maharaj. Now, God Kishordas Babaji Maharaj was a very close associate of Bhaktivinoda Thakur. He was an extraordinary person himself, who was actually a grain merchant, who had but after his wife died, he became a Babaji, and he took this opportunity to develop his, to devote his life for Naam Kirtan and Bhajan. But God Krishna's Babaji Maharaj could not tolerate anything but unmotivated service. So many people would come for asking for blessings. We heard that in the earlier, give me blessings. That is what people want for their own selfish needs. So he wanted to avoid that. So he deliberately would stay in where the people would come to respond to nature. So he would go and stay near a latrine in the, you know, somewhere in the woods, which is very smelly areas. So people generally don't like to go there. There was one person who was very impressed by him, and he wanted to actually build him a bhajan kutir. So he said, no, I don't want a bhajan kutir, because people will then start coming to bhajan kutir. I just want to, you give me, take me to a latrine, then I will, you know, toilet, I will stay nearby. And there was, he used to stay under that overturned boat, and under that was his place. So nobody externally could kind of make out that he was who he was. But he was such a simple person, but such deep devotion to Krishna, and his understanding of the and his depth of his love was tremendous. But it was not known to the general people. So here you have somebody who was not educated in the academic sense, from the external sense, and who was living a life like this. And here you have, and who never took any disciples. He refused to take any disciples, and he would in fact discourage them. But Bhaktivinoda Thakur could see the greatness of this pure devotee, and he instructed his son Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati that you should take initiation from him. So here was Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, who was a scholar, had won so many awards, and he went and had the very beautiful exchanges when he went to meet God Kishordas Babaji Maharaj. And God Kishordas Babaji Maharaj kept rejecting him, saying that, no, I don't give, you take it from Bhaktivinoda Thakur, I'm not giving any session. 2-3 times he told him no, and he brushed him off. And such was the intensity of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, that when he felt that God Kishordas Babaji Maharaj was serious about it and he was not going to give him, he actually went to give up his body. He was about to commit suicide, because when God Kishordas Babaji Maharaj was actually testing him, and then he caught his hand. Because he said that Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati said that my life is useless if I cannot accept you as my guru, if you don't accept me as your disciple. So he completely humbled himself. So he had no attraction at all, attraction for his, though he was so brilliant and he knew so many languages and he understood transcendental nature of all varieties. He had mastered all the understandings, and that he had become one of the most powerful speakers in the planet. But yet, He never saw this. He considered himself illiterate. He considered himself unqualified. So, and he became extremely devoted and attached to his Guru Maharaj, Gaur Kishwardas Babaji Maharaj. So he had two Gurus, Shikshak Guru and Dikshak Guru. So when both these, within a span of a year, in 1916 and 1917, both of them departed from this world, Bhaktivinoda Thakur and Gaur Kishwardas Babaji Maharaj. So Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur was extremely disheartened. He felt depressed, he felt dejected, because Bhaktivinoda Thakur and his Guru Maharaj both had told, given him instructions to preach all over the world, and he felt himself not only illiterate, but he felt unqualified. He felt and he felt that I don't have that personality, I don't have the charisma to preach like that, and I'm unqualified. That was his humility. But he told his disciples later, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, okay, I was feeling all alone, and I was actually feeling that how am I going to do it, because just a few neophyte devotees were with him. And then one night he had a vision, and he was in Brajpattan, I think, place called Brajpattan, which is not far from Yogapeet in Mayapur. So he, and in that vision, actually Chaitanya Mahaprabhu came with all his associates, Gadadhar Pandit, Advaita Acharya, Shivas Thakur, and Haridas Thakur, six Goswamis. He also saw both his gurus also in that same Harinam, and they were all doing ecstatic Harinam. And then they spoke to him and told him that you're not all alone, we are all with you, and through you, our mission will be successful. So go ahead and go ahead with full enthusiasm. And this is what Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj told his disciples much later. And that's how he then took up the challenge, and he established 64 temples, Gaudiya Math, and his disciples were extraordinary preachers. Some of us also had the good fortune of meeting, the great fortune of meeting a few who were in their late 80s, early 90s, in maybe 10, 15, 15, 20 years ago. Even in, because this, they had already, many had departed, but some were still there. And even at that age of, in the late 80s, early 90s, their deep desire to preach was extraordinary. One would think that on 92 you're barely about to just trying to survive the next moment, and here they only thought of the preaching. There's so much, and the powerful understanding and for philosophy that Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj was, that was his training. So that combination of humility and training, that was so extraordinary. And then he made some special prophecies, many prophecies, which all came true. Because the first was when we know that this is where his link with Srila Prabhupada comes in. And I'll conclude with that, and then Adi Kesha Prabhu will take over. Our beloved Srila Prabhupada, His Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada, explains when he tells so proudly how he met his Guru Maharaj, Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj, in 1922, when his friend Narendra took him to Ulta Dunga Junction, where Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj was there. And as soon as Prabhupada, he was not very keen, first of all. He had seen, I have many sadhus, and I have seen so many of them there. They're the same. And he was in that nationalist mood, in that mood to get independence from the British for India. And he was, with Subhash Chandra Bose and others. So at that moment when he went to meet, he paid obeisances as a respectful Bengali, because he also had a very... very, very high elevated devotee as parents. So, first statement of Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj was that you are an educated young man, why don't you go all over the world and preach? Now, he didn't even ask his name, he didn't anything, he just straight away pointedly told him the instruction which he, in 1922, which till 1977, either it was in the planning stage or execution stage, but it was the key instruction which Prabhupada took in his heart from that time. Initially it was latent, later on it became manifest. But that was the power of Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj, which actually came through his purity, and he could and it became a prophecy that when he made a request. And of course, our Prabhupada was initially arguing that first we should get liberation from the British, then we can talk about liberation. Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur Prabhupada very strongly and boldly, emphatically explained to him that how, if you are these external temporary situations of governance, of who's controlling which country, etc., will keep changing. But unless you become self-conscious, unless you improve your consciousness, unless you become liberated from the cycle of birth and death, what is all this? There's no value to anything. That is the most important thing. And that made a big impression on Prabhupada. So Prabhupada, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada, when he was telling his devotees many times later on, very proudly, that my Guru Maharaj defeated me. That was his humility and that is his pride. So for us, actually, seeing Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, none of us have seen him. We know him through the scriptures. We know him through other devotees who have either heard him or a few who have met him. But we can understand that for us, our entire world is, ISKCON has been created by Srila Prabhupada. He's the perfect person. He has done everything and he's changed every aspect of our lives. Now, when we see that such a person, we see him like a young boy who's taking his guidance from somebody, then we wonder, who's that person who's that kind of, how much like a father to him, like a guru to him. So we get a glimpse of what the purity of the parampara is, that a personality beyond whom we cannot even see. For us, Prabhupada is the ultimate in everything. But he, in fact, was never felt that his guru was away from him for even a moment. So that is one way we can also understand Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. So apart from that prophecy, then later in the early 30s, when Prabhupada was still a grihastha, and then a situation came when some of the others in the Bombay Gaudiya Math, which is very near from our temple, at that time it was at Nagovalia Tank, just opposite August Kranti Maidan. So Prabhupada was visited there regularly, and some of the disciples were, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur disciples had recommended, and were strongly feeling that Abhay Charan should actually become the president and join the temple full time. So Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj made the prophecy that no, just leave him. Let him, it is better that he stays outside the temple from you. And let him be. When the time comes, he will do everything. You don't need to recommend him. So that was another time when he did that. And then there are many incidents like this, but there's one special one which Nayananda Das Brahmachari, Nayananda Das Maharaj, who's also a disciple of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, he's quoted in this book from Moola Prakriti Devi, Prabhupada disciple, who wrote this book just before she left this planet. And she said that, she quoted this Nayananda Das Maharaj, who was describing what happened, that it was in the mid 30s, just before Srila Prabhupada, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur left this planet. At that time, this Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj had actually sent some devotees to London. They had come back and they couldn't succeed. And he was giving a series of discourses at Champahati Mandir, and afternoon he came to know that this London devotees have come back, devotees had gone to London and they were unsuccessful. It was very difficult for them to stay there, couldn't preach there. And then in the evening he was giving the discourse, and then Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur was telling, there were thousands of pilgrims and others who were in the Champahati Mandir, and he was explaining to them that, telling him how much his own strong desire was that this mission spreads all over the world. And then he was mentioning that Bhaktivinoda Thakur's, his father's deep desire was to spread this, and his instructions to him were also, And his own mother, Bhagavati Devi, had also, her last wish before leaving this world was the same. So he was just saying about that how critical it is to spread this all over the world. And at that moment, he then he just fell silent. And then he was gazing at the large crowd that was assembled there. And there was one section where all the sannyasis and brahmacharis were sitting. This is what Nayananda Das Maharaj is saying. He was in the audience, he was sitting little ahead, means nearer to Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj. And he saw Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur look towards his left, where the sannyasis and the brahmacharis were sitting. And then at that time, there was such a long pause. Many seconds went by. So, you know, when somebody's speaking and he stops, you know, and then, you know, people are waiting and waiting. So, when he was looking at that crowd, and then Nayananda Das Maharaj noticed that he was gazing at one person intently. So, imagine we're sitting here, he was looking at Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj, and he saw his gaze there. So, he turned, and then he saw that in that crowd, that Abhay Charan was sitting there as Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. And he saw that there was, for a long time, there was the gaze met. They're looking at each other. And that when they were looking at each other, there was a mystifying experience. This is his words. He's saying it was mystifying, very mysterious. That they were exchanging messages or whatever, but there was a very deep look between the two. Both were looking at each other. And then after several seconds had gone by, then Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur turned back and he started speaking to the crowd. And he said, "I make a prediction that one of my disciples will go all over the world and bring the world back." Jai Srila Prabhupada. So there are many other, this is the power of Bhaktisiddhanta. So each parampara line has come with a mission. And it is not for us to even fathom what the mission was. But each has to do in setting the whole stage and for the next person. It's like a relay. And we are like the ants who are crawling on the ground, and these are the giants who are like running with the baton and getting the ants to grow. So this is how Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj handed the baton, which came from God Krishna Babaji Maharaj, and each one has had role to play, right up Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So it is this mysterious leela of the Lord and his pure devotees. All that we can see from the scriptures is that they have come to save us, and it is our greatest fortune to follow them if we get a chance. Our greatest misfortune to just take it theoretically or to avoid it because of any, either because if you've got some, we find it too difficult or we are not convinced, whatever. So actually there's nothing coincidental that what happens. So if you've got a chance, it is actually for our own benefit. So at this stage I'll end. Is Adikesha Prabhu here? So Adikesha Prabhu will now speak on his divine grace, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur Maharaj. Hare Krishna.